Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure to stay to the end of today's podcast to find out how you can win a copy of Rust and Bone on DVD. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a belated episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me, as always, two members of my wonderful cinematic family. There is Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Well, calm down with the family stuff, but hello. It's nice to see you again.
Excellent. And Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey, welcome to the family.
We're so family-focused today because the movie that we'll be talking about is Stoker, the newest from director Park Chan-wook, who is best known probably on these shores for directing Oldboy. It stars Mia Wasikowska, Nicole Kidman, and Matthew Good.
Wasikowska.
All right. Calm down, Nick. I'm tired of you correcting me, even when I'm wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's not easy when I'm always right.
I know. It must be a torment for you to have to endure this week after week. But before we get into that, just wanted to say thanks for listening, and you should subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a comment and or a rating. Actually, you know what? Not and or. Just do both. And as always, you can send us an email at podcast@thefilmstage.com if you have any in-depth questions you'd like us to address on the air. Before we get into talking about Stoker, as I said, the newest film from the director of Oldboy, we wanted to take a look at other foreign directors who've gone from making films either in their own language or in any other foreign language before making the jump to these American shores. And we wanted to take a look at kind of what the track record is for these people when they come over here and try to adapt their style to the American film scene. Gotta say, we were throwing some names around, and very few success stories, and even fewer enduring success stories. Nick Newman, why don't you kick us off and let us know some of the directors that you found that you thought were worth mentioning in this vein?
You know, funny enough, you say how there are few success stories, and that's very true, but two of my favorite directors, two of my favorite foreign directors as well, who went on to do English language features, actually, in my view, succeeded. The first of those, and the older of those, is Michelangelo Antonioni, who directed Blow Up in 1966, which was after such films as Il Grido and La Ventura, La Notte, and Le Clis. And this feature was a very different, sort of a culture shock if you were to watch his prior films, because those were all set in Italy and they all had a very Italian sort of sensibility to them. They had a sensibility of certain Italian filmmakers of that era. And then he goes to England and he transposes that onto a very, very British movie. Because Blow Up, while it has a compelling mystery at its center, is as much about it is as much a study of London during that time as it is a story of a man who is trying to figure out the, you know, the circumstances behind this murder that he thinks he captures. And there is that issue of cultural transposition, which I think makes the work more interesting, as is the case with Wong Kar-wai, who in 2007 made My Blueberry Nights, which is his sort of road movie, almost. It's this very strange, amorphous, almost shapeless feature about this woman played by singer-songwriter Nora Jones, who goes across the country and encounters all these different people, which, again, adds an interesting lens to the story because, in fact, this is a movie made by a person who is going around the country encountering things he's never seen before. So there is, an emboldening that happens there, even if that one, for instance, is not completely successful. Those are two examples of movies that sort of gain something extra when you know the story behind them. And in this case, it happens to be the circumstances of their directors.
I see. And Danny, were you able to find any movies that you thought were successful or gained something by the circumstances of their directors coming over here for the first time?
Well, to start things off, I think it's good that Nick brought up those two examples because, like Stoker, they kind of form nicely together in this category of a director making several films in their home country and sort of developing a signature before making the transition to English language. And I feel like before Stoker came out, there were a lot of these lists that were made, like top 10 English language debuts, as if it was sort of a category as seamless as like top 10 films of the year or something in that manner. But there are a lot of movies that sort of make you approach the category in a less concrete way. If you look at like Roman Polanski's Repulsion, which I believe is technically an English language debut, but it's only his second feature film. So it's like you have to, that doesn't quite have the same punch as something like My Blueberry Nights or Blow Up when calling it a director's English language debut. I think you could even say the same thing for a recent movie like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy by Thomas Alfredson, which he made after Let the Right One In. And then there are even cases with like films like Certified Copy where it's like half English, but since Kiarostami's previous work was so predominantly Iranian, it's tempting to kind of lump it into that category. So, I mean, overall, I think there are a lot of success stories like the ones I mentioned. It just kind of depends on how strict you want to be with the categorization.
Yeah, and that is a big question that we had, because I was able to find a decent number of directors who had like the one big foreign hit that put them on the map, and then it was suddenly like a rush to get them over here and working. And I think those are the ones that unfortunately seem to have found the least amount of success. When we were talking before, I brought up the director of The Lives of Others, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, which Nick aptly pointed out is the most German name ever. And he did The Lives of Others and then made The Tourist, which I think was it was nominated for Golden Globe for Best Musical and Comedy, right?
Yeah, I think it was.
Like, that was the weird craziness that happened with that. Then there was Oliver Hirschbiegel?
I think so.
Thank you, Nick. And he went from making Downfall to making Invasion, or The Invasion, which was the Nicole Kidman Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake that went through all kinds of nonsense on its way to the screens. I mean, it's just, it's kind of sad because they seem to have had so much potential. And they made such assured international debuts, I guess you would call them, that it's just a little sad that when they come over here, it just kind of all seems to fall apart. Now you're stuck wondering if they still have a future and if you're going to be able to see something that approaches something like The Lives of Others or Downfall. Some other people that I've found, though, who've had a little more niche success, I guess. First of all, Wolfgang Petersen went from making Das Boot to making Never Ending Story. Enemy Mine, In the Line of Fire, Outbreak, Air Force One, The Perfect Storm. I mean, those are some heavy films. Some films that got a lot of interesting reactions. Unfortunately, like Troy and Poseidon seem to have torpedoed what he had, but he had a good run. He had like a good 20-year run of English language films. And then we have more recent examples, like Kim Ji-woon, who made The Last Stand, the Arnold Schwarzenegger vehicle that kind of bombed earlier. Christoph Gans, who directed Brotherhood of the Wolf, and then came over here and made a Silent Hill film. I mean,
oh dear.
Yeah, right? There's not... Timur Bekmambetov is a special case for me, because I actually still like the films he's making. I don't know if any of them have been financially successful. He made Night Watch and Day Watch over in Russia, and then brought his insane, just off-the-wall directing style to Wanted and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which is one of my guilty pleasure films from last year. But yeah, I don't know, guys. Looking at this list, it's kind of difficult to understand what these people hope to gain by coming here and what's to be formed by looking at the cycle of who has made it and who has not. We have Inwar Itu.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to...
I mean, he's an interesting case just in the sense that he keeps flip-flopping.
Yeah, he continuously moves through the ideas of language. And actually, you know, his film Babel is kind of a great microcosm for what we're talking about here, because it actually has to do with the difficulties of communicating between different people because of language barriers and cultural barriers. And, you know, whether or not you think the film was successful is up to your own discretion. But it is interesting that he addressed something like that while himself moving back and forth between languages while filming. Nick, you did not like Babel? Or do you just not like
Babel? I've actually never finished it. I turned it off after like an hour or so.
All right.
It was years ago, and I just thought, you know, no, I've seen everything here.
I got it, right? Yeah. You know, talking is hard. Yeah, that movie, I think I appreciated what it was trying to do more than what it actually did. It's unfortunately a little didactic, a little heavy-handed.
Yeah, yeah, a little.
A little. So I just want to throw out one more person that I thought of, Fernando Morales, who did City of God.
Oh, yeah.
And then did The Constant Gardener and followed that up with Blindness. And then I think he had another film that came out recently called, like, 365 or something.
360. Yeah, it's supposed to be bad.
Which
yeah,
I heard is quite poor.
I liked The Constant Gardener. I also liked Blindness, though less than The Constant Gardener. So I guess if he is a series of diminishing returns, 360 would probably be the point where I break off. But not having seen it yet, I can't really cast any aspersions on it. So yeah, I'm not sure what there is to be learned by looking at this, as I've said, but it is interesting just to see the way that we kind of attract these talents that have been played up so much, and then the second that they seem to get here, it becomes a crapshoot.
I think one interesting aspect of discussion is just the idea of how we anticipate these films, because there's a sense that, like, just staying with Park Chan-wook as an example, part of the reason, like, why people may have been attracted to his films is because they were kind of like this niche item. You know, Old Boy was really popular, but his other films are kind of these very violent and kind of queasily funny films that don't appeal to anyone. And so the idea of him coming over to try and make a film that'll reach a larger audience, you know, that's something that even fans of his might be skeptical about from the beginning.
Well, that's my question, especially with someone like him. I mean, Old Boy, I feel like it's one of those movies that a lot of people have surprisingly seen. And I just don't know if making one in English, a film in English like Stoker, is really going to expand that at all. You know, like, was that really the intent?
Yeah.
Was to come over and get a wider audience? Because I feel like a lot of what people dug about Old Boy was, it's a foreign film and it's crazy. You know,
yeah.
That's kind of how you get initiated into it.
I think, A, most of the people who end up seeing Stoker have either been familiar with his work, or B, most of the people who end up seeing Stoker won't pay enough attention to the director's name to look up what else he's done.
Yeah.
So, I'm a little skeptical of how big an impact this will have on his overall exposure, especially because this is, you know, it's not a wide release. It's generally a limited.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. I feel like that a lot of the people we talked about. I just remembered John Woo. Everyone remember John Woo?
Yeah. Oh, I do remember that guy.
Right? He was awesome. Broken Arrow, Face Off, Mission Impossible 2, and then it all went to crap. But, yeah, I mean, those are people who, like, really came over an explosive opening. Like, multi-thousands of screens and all that stuff. Like, most of the people we've talked about are like that. But it seems like Park Chan-wook with Stoker kept it to about what you would expect one of his foreign films to be released at.
Mm.
I don't know. I think that's probably for the best,
yeah.
Considering how some of these other people have panned out. You know, that niche appeal doesn't always move towards giant mainstream appeal.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I'm not sure what we've learned, but hopefully this has been at least vaguely educational for the people at home. But I think
we should, actually, you know, we haven't mentioned the finest example of that transition.
Okay.
F.W. Murnau, Songrise, A Son
of
Oh,
Fire. Sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's actually, yeah, that's not a bad one. I was thinking.
Not a bad one.
So that being said, let us move on now into our feature review of the film Stoker, as we've said, by Park Chan-wook, starring Mia Wasikowska, Nicole Kidman, and Matthew Good.
You know, I've often wondered why it is we have children. And the conclusion I've come to is we want someone to get it right this time. But not me. Personally speaking, I can't wait to watch life tear you apart.
Indigo, is something wrong?
Yes. My father is dead.
So Stoker is the story of India, who is, I believe, at the time of the film, turning 18. And on her birthday, her father is killed in a horrible car accident. And following his death, she meets for the first time her Uncle Charlie, played with a kind of creepy atmosphere by Matthew Good. And the movie is about kind of figuring out the mystery behind Charlie's sudden appearance and the mystery behind India's own macabre predilections. So guys, what did we think of this film? Let's start with Nick. Why don't you give us your spoiler-free thoughts on Stoker?
Yeah, in general, I was quite surprised by Stoker because I went in not entirely optimistic. The only Park film I have seen beforehand is Old Boy, which I am something of an outlier on. I don't really care for it, to be honest. And going in, I had heard that this has a lot of classic Park stamps, so I guess I thought, well, if this is going to be more like that, I might as well just prepare myself. And as it went on, I found myself growing. I found it growing on me, I should say. And I can't exactly pinpoint what that would come down to, because I don't think the script by Wentworth Miller is terribly good. I think that there is an obvious narrative slack to be found, and I think that there's poor character development when this is at times trying to be a character piece. But there is something, there's a sort of a fun spirit to it, and there's a very energetic vibe that comes from Park's direction, which I think carries throughout. It's not just these flourishes that are peppering the opening sequences. It's from stop to start, he's making these seemingly mundane experiences, these dinner conversations or walking home from school, for instance, and he's turning them into these amazingly captivating visual exposés, sort of. And yeah, so that is really sort of, I guess ultimately that's what I gravitated toward. And on the performance side of things, I found that everybody was they're all sort of doing very different things. There's sort of a clashing of performances here that I think actually works to the movie's benefit. That's something that I can give the screenplay, is the way that these characters bounce off one another and they come to shape each other. Mia Wasikowska, who I'm still not entirely sure what to make of, just because I've seen her in, I believe the only thing I've seen her in prior was Jane Eyre, which I did like, but I wasn't entirely comfortable with in some ways.
I know something else you've seen her in.
What would that be?
Lawless.
Oh God, that's right. Wow. Well, she had a non-character in that. But the highlight,
you didn't see The Kids Are All Right either.
Oh wow, yeah. Maybe this is saying something about her that I don't.
I was about to say, I feel like we've struck upon
this. Yeah, awkward.
Ouch.
Anyway. So yeah, and then Nicole Kidman is interesting, I can say that much, but I think the standout is certainly Matthew Good, who understands, I think, the screenplay's fault in that there's no ambiguity, so he's not playing it as ambiguous at all. He shows up first at a distance at the father's funeral, smiling with sunglasses on, which, if that doesn't tell you everything...
Right, standing on top of a burial mound.
Like. Yeah, if that doesn't tell you everything, you probably have a certain difficulty in grasping basic tenets of foreshadowing. If you can even call that foreshadowing. To me, he's the on-screen highlight of this entire movie.
I definitely agree with you there. Matthew Good. I love Matthew Good. He's been very good. Damn it. I was really trying to stop myself from saying that.
Of quality?
I apologize. He has been a standout in everything that I have seen him in. A Single Man, The Lookout, Match Point, just to name a few. I know he was in Watchmen, but I didn't see that, so I'm going to stay away from that one. But I was excited for this movie purely because of him, because even though I have seen some other Park Chan-wook films, I saw Old Boy, of course. I also saw Thirst. And while I liked both of them, I don't know, it's not enough to get me in a theater. I was certainly interested, and the fact that the movie was marketed in a way that I didn't know what it was about, you know, it was interesting. I was interested, but Matthew Good got me into the theater. And he was definitely the standout in this as well, for exactly the reasons you say. He gets it, and he plays it to the hilt, and it's pretty fantastic. Every time that he's on screen, it's just incredible. Nicole Kidman, yeah, she's there. She's doing something. I don't know. I don't know that I entirely understand what it is, but I appreciated it now and then. I feel as though, however, that a lot of the deficiencies in her character come from the writing more than her performance.
It's a sort of a 14 years later version of her character from Eyes Wide Shut, I think.
That's probably true. Yeah, I mean, there are some spoilery things that we can get into. Needless to say, Kidman equips herself well, but there's just kind of a letdown in her character. And I think that Mia, I'm not going to attempt to pronounce her last name again, she does good in certain parts. She does well. But I mean, I feel like the problem with this film is, and it's a problem that's going to run throughout the entire course of my time discussing it, is just the fact that it strikes such an ominous chord to begin with. The tension and the sense of dread and something on the horizon is struck so heavy the first time from the first opening scenes, but it never varies itself. It's always the same notes of dread, and it's just hit that one time and then sustained. And so the very sense of, like, weirdness and tension and dread becomes monotonous at a point because there's no escalation. And the machinations of the plot are not well modulated. And so while I was interested and while I was definitely invested, a lot of my attention started to seep out just because I didn't feel like, from that first introduction of the character of Charlie, that anything new was coming into the fore. Like, he just announces himself as a presence of some malignant intent, and that's it, and that's all he ever is, and there's no jump up from there. And so it just becomes kind of wearying. But Danny, what about yourself? Are we speaking your language, or did you have a different opinion about this film?
I see where you guys are coming from. I definitely, like, love this movie, actually. I've seen it twice. Because I think it has some sequences that are just kind of the most cinematically enjoyable of any I've seen so far this year, just in terms of how kind of crazy and go for broke the cross-cutting gets, and kind of how it just rejects logic in favor of style, basically. I found it kind of like a really addicting experience. But I think it works because it's kind of a film that's sort of hyper subjective, especially the opening act or so, when you're kind of hearing all these sound bites from the periphery and you're sort of learning that India is kind of this almost superhuman being in some ways, where she can hear all these side conversations and they kind of act like whispering on the soundtrack. And it's kind of this very immersive experience for me. And you know, Brian, you mentioned Thirst, the director's previous film, which I actually love a lot as well. And Thirst is like a literal vampire movie. And I think Stoker, if like in terms of just her last name, the title of the film, and kind of some of her behaviors, there's an intriguing kind of layer of vampirism going on. And even with Matthew Good's character, you can make that claim.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's also some sexuality, because they should call her Stroker, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
And one of the many great lines from Wentworth Miller's screenplay.
I mean, on Wentworth Miller's scripts, I think it takes some guts to go from starring in Prison Break, which I haven't seen. I haven't seen Prison Break, to kind of writing a script that basically rips off Shadow of a Doubt for its kind of whole story. And I think that the way it does it is actually interesting, because the film operates, when I'm interpreting it, it's both a English language debut for Park Chan-wook as well as kind of a remake of Shadow of a Doubt in some ways. And one of the things it does for me is make the girl the main character. In Shadow of a Doubt, Joseph Cotten kind of steals the show for me throughout the movie, but here India is the main character. And like you said, Matthew Good strikes the same note throughout, and I think that's intentional. And so I like the way that it kind of twists this potentially mysterious story into kind of a really odd, off-kilter coming-of-age story. Like you said, it's not about is he a killer or isn't he. That's made fairly obvious early in the film. And so I found things to enjoy it where maybe you thought Miller was kind of spinning his wheels.
Well, it definitely does seem like he's spinning his wheels, because there seems to be, for at least the first third of the movie, a lot of ambiguity about whether Charlie is or isn't a killer. It's just like...
Is there, though?
I feel like... I don't know if they were trying to or they were making a joke about how obvious it was.
No, I think it's a joke.
Okay, if it's a joke, I can deal with it a little more. But it's just like... I just don't know, guys.
It's both a joke, but even if it's not, it's still revealed earlier than, like, Hitchcock did it. Or it's revealed earlier than a film that kind of hinges on that secret would have. I think that the fact that you learn so early on in the film is sort of a signal that there are some other things they're trying to go after.
I guess so. Okay, so here's my thing. I'm ready to get into spoilers. I don't know if you all need to discuss some more of this movie in the non-spoilers.
I'd like to talk a bit about the sound design, which I thought was quite impressive. And
yeah, that's true.
And for two reasons. One is that, there's a very organic meld of sort of the immediate foreground of sound and the background of it, to the point where it's like what Danny said, it becomes this subjective experience. And there are moments where I actually could not tell what was being whispered, what was a secret, and what was out in the open, which I think complements a few themes of the movie and maybe some problems that you could have with Matthew Good's character. I think that is a sign that it is sort of joking about his quote-unquote ambiguity, the fact that it's able to be so bald-faced about things like that when other movies would not, in fact. But secondly, it was also interesting to note that I could swear, and Danny, you've seen it twice, so maybe you can comment upon this. I could swear Matthew Good's character also has that same ability, too.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
He does, okay. I feel like the movie didn't explicitly state it.
I don't think it does.
Right.
Does it? I don't know. Well, I don't know at what point something becomes explicit.
I noticed in the sequence with the jocks at school, it was very interesting the way Park superimposed that audio over the image of his back to the camera and sort of how he's reacting as if he's hearing it himself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which I think the fact that it wasn't so obvious only adds to the menace of the character. The fact that he might have this extra ability that makes him... that makes him even more menacing, which is sort of expanded upon later on when India is on the phone to the sheriff and, you know, you only hear the sound of the operator, which, interestingly enough, is contrasted with the image of Charlie standing there looking menacing with the garden shears, right? Mm-hmm. And it was just so... I was surprised at how well integrated it was, because I feel like many films today are not taking full advantage of sound, which sounds kind of strange, I know, but it feels like most movies, you know, when you watch the Oscars, for instance, and they have the sound awards up, and you're always thinking to yourself, well, I don't know if I really noticed something like that. Like when Skyfall wins an award for that, you understand because there's a lot of loud bangs and gunshots and there's music mixed in. But this is a movie that I feel like could almost be used as an instructional tool for how to successfully implement sound.
Yeah,
I was quite taken with it.
I would say most of the technical aspects of this film were actually very good. And Nick, you said that, you know, there aren't just flourishes of a directorial touch, but there's a very firm directorial hand on the entire thing. And I can get behind that. I don't want my negative statements to be misconstrued as saying that this film is inept or it's not well made. I think it is. I think that the acting is as good as the writing can allow it to be, and I think that the writing is stronger than the story needs it to be. And the second that the scene with the hard-boiled egg, when she can hear people talking about her father and the way that he died, and she starts, you know, to listen to the sound of the shell and the egg cracking, and you can hear the fight between the cracking of the egg and their voices. I mean, it's fantastic. It's beautiful. It's a great scene. It may be one of my top scenes of the year thus far. And, you know, a movie that does not have some worth to it cannot create a scene like that. It's just, I don't know, there's a lack of cohesion, and as I said, there's a lack of escalation that really, it made it harder to watch all of these really wonderful things that are happening and not feel like I was watching something that was one or two more passes away from being something that was really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Did everybody else really like the production design too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did, yes.
One thing that there's this very brief image that I think encapsulates the idea behind the production design, which is when Uncle Charlie brings home chocolate and vanilla ice cream, and he hands it to India, and she picks it up, and it's not, you know, Ben and Jerry's or Edie's or whatever kind of brand. It's just this very generic yellow and brown stripes.
It looks so good, though.
But, yeah, what's interesting about it is how I heard someone – I didn't even think of this until afterward, and I'm surprised I didn't because it feels so evident. But someone compared the production design of this movie to Blue Velvet in the sense that it feels like it absolutely takes place in the modern day. But there's nothing about it that would indicate that it actually takes place in the modern day. It could easily be set in the 50s because you never see a character use a cell phone. You never really see a character watch TV.
Wait, don't you?
Do you?
I think you see TV with the bird kind of documentary.
Yeah, okay. But that's in an old TV set. But I could have sworn that... No, there's definitely a cell phone. We can get into it in spoilers. And I think that the mother is at some point listening to an iPod. But those touches are put in so nonchalantly, and they're in the midst of all this other stuff that it does feel slightly removed from time. I know exactly what you're talking about, but I was able to find those touches of something. That and the cars, but...
Yeah, I actually mentioned those ice cream things in my review that I wrote the other day because they were so funny to me. And, like, there are a lot of other details like that where the film feels like it could be a few decades in the past.
Yeah. I do love that, like, it's weird that we're all talking about the ice cream. I mean, that is, like, great production design because I've been to places that have the local ice cream parlor that will sell you those, like, you know, tubs of, like, their fresh-made ice cream. And it just says, like, chocolate. And then it has the stripes on it, and everyone knows where they're from. And, that's probably why I've wanted ice cream for the last 3 days.
Yeah.
I haven't had any. And it's driving me nuts.
All this. And I think it had something to do with this, so.
All right. But, yeah, so now that we've talked about that, now that we've praised the movie to within an inch of its life for all of its technical skills and given kudos to some of the actors, I would like to delve into the plot a little bit before we wrap everything up, because I think there is where I find a few of my more, I don't know, my troubling points, the parts that are really going to stick why I didn't appreciate this film as much as I would have liked to. So is everyone ready for spoilers?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
All right, so... So I think the big reveal in this film, because again, they play the Charlie thing almost like a reveal, like, yes, he kills people. It's just like, for some strange reason, they're like, oh no, where's the housekeeper that India saw him talking to threateningly? She's dead. She's obviously dead. And she's in the freezer that's in the creepiest basement in the world that she has to light by, like, flinging light fixtures. Anyway... But the real reveal comes from, where does Uncle Charlie come from? What is happening? And it turns out that he's been writing her letters from, like, all over the world, talking about his crazy adventures and how much he's looking forward to meeting her. And she's like, oh, you know, thank God, someone who's like me, he understands. And then she starts walking to his room. And then she notices that they're all from an insane asylum. And then he arrives some point later and... She asks about, like, the younger brother that no one ever talked about, like, her father's younger brother, who would have been her nephew, not her nephew, her uncle. And it just feels like all of this happens in, like, 15 minutes. And we've gone through, like, an hour of this film just coasting on this one initial bad feeling that Uncle Charlie gives us. And then finally all this shit comes out. And so there's no subtle, gradual... twisting of the knife. It's just suddenly like, here it comes, and then it's over. Am I the only person who felt that way? Because I was really let down by the pacing of those reveals.
I felt that the reveal just in itself is faulty and is a bad idea, because there is something about it which I think kind of comes to retroactively undermines the action of the preceding two acts when he's this mysterious figure, and he's sort of, I don't know, to me the screenplay felt very clear in stating that this is someone who she's never met before and doesn't really know about necessarily, because he just sort of appears and he doesn't, there's no mention of an Uncle Charlie before he even speaks. And something about knowing after the fact that, oh, well, she was acquainted with him as a young girl doesn't, it to me is not as compelling, even though I do think there is the chance to add depth. The weakness, one of the weaknesses in Wentworth Miller's screenplay is that it in fact does not.
But wait, they weren't acquainted when they were younger.
Well, no, but they were conversing. That's what I mean. Just the fact that they were having that any sort of correspondence.
Well, he was corresponding.
He was corresponding. She never read any of those.
Yeah, I know. But what I'm saying is that there is a familiarity there, which I don't. Oh. I'm just not. I don't know. I'm just not comfortable with it because. You know that he's tried to reach her before yes. Her father, to me, doesn't work quite as well.
See, I like the idea that he was out to find her, but had been kept away. Spoiler alert, we're already in spoilers, by her father, who Charlie then murders in order to get to her. I don't know how he knew that she existed in the first place. I guess that the father thought it was cool to tell his, like, psychopath, homicidal brother that he had a daughter, and that she might be like him, because they have to go hunting to keep her, like, savage impulses in check. I don't know. Like, I just, there's madness is all I can think. Like, those twists come out so quick, and they increasingly make less and less sense. And they happen so fast that I'm not even fully adjusted to the idea that he knew about her but had been kept away from her, that by the time I find out 2 seconds later that he was in a mental asylum, and so all of the things that I just was learning to accept as reality were lies, I don't feel like I've had the rug pulled out from under me, because I just saw the rug for the first time, and I hadn't even put it on the floor yet. And so that's where my problem comes in, because I feel like those things could have amounted to something a little greater than the sum of their parts, but they never really did.
Yeah.
And especially the way that... There's a part of me that thought that this was going to be like... At some point, the father would come back, honestly, and he would... You know, take his brother and his daughter away from his nutso wife, who he had obviously become removed from, and they'd go off and be killers together. Yeah. That's really where it seemed to be going.
I don't know how you waste Dermot Mulroney.
You don't know how you waste Dermot Mulroney?
I'm mostly joking. I mean, he's fine, but he's, you know.
He's in the movie for, like, a headshot and a single scene.
Yeah, it is kind of, even though I am sort of making fun of him unfairly, it is weird that he's here, just because he's not, if you just got some nobody actor, if you got Wentworth Miller, for instance, it wouldn't feel as strange that he appears in quick flashbacks and then is killed off and that's kind of it, yeah. Because it is what you said, you sort of expect him to come back, right. Which, I don't know, maybe is a subversion of audience expectations, but I don't think that's actually the case, because the screenplay doesn't hint at that idea.
To do that, no.
It's not that it's not strong enough to do that. It's that it never even attempts to do that. I think there's one
scene when the housekeepers are talking about, like, oh, you know, his body was so badly burned that, like, they couldn't even see it was him. And I was like, oh, he's coming back, I guess. Because, like, you never hear about someone who dies in a car accident. It's like, you know, oh, he was so badly burned they didn't even know if it was him or not. Like, they couldn't identify the body. Like, who says that? You don't say that unless you're obviously trying to set up the fact that this person will be back. But he was not. He's just Dermot Mulroney, and he's dead. Beaten with a rock in a car. And then Nicole Kidman just suddenly becomes, like, Sherlock Holmes at some point. She puts everything together. This is only, however, after it becomes clear that Charlie wants to have relations with India and not with her. Like, as soon as sex is off the table, she starts putting the pieces together, and she's like, oh, right, he's a psychotic killer.
Yeah, she's a questionable mother. There's no question.
Not a great mother figure. I guess it's just things like that. Again, like, they're, if you had taken another swipe at this script, I feel like these things could have been ironed out, and they could have jostled maybe some scene structure and just made everything work a little bit more. But we don't even get a feel for India as a normal girl, because we meet her only when her father's dead. Apparently she's always been weird. And I don't know, like, I don't feel like there's a tug of war going on for her soul. which is what Charlie, I believe, is supposed to represent, this, like, force of darkness coming to subvert all the good that her father was trying to do. I don't know, it feels like a really great idea executed not to the best of its ability. I don't know, guys.
Yeah, I kind of agree, but I feel sort of bad for saying this in a way, but I think I like this as a piece of form over content.
Oh, no, I mean, I will probably watch this again.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I'm sure this Blu-ray will look beautiful, and it's very entertaining to watch, too. I'm just saying, I'm not always comfortable with that stance, but I think that is the case here. Funny enough, I was actually thinking today that this is sort of tying back to what we discussed, almost a reverse version of that. This movie reminds me a lot of David Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. In which case you have a director who was working in a foreign land, even though in the case of Fincher, he was working with basically native actors native to himself. But you have him working with this pulpy, strange screenplay that doesn't really have enough to it to sustain itself, I think. But the project itself is able to be sustained by the immense skill of the person behind the camera. And when you come out of it, like with Stoker, you're mostly talking about what Fincher is doing or what the actors are doing. You're not necessarily talking about, what's his name? The guy who looks like a cokehead. Steve Zaillian. You're not necessarily talking about what he's done in adapting Stieg Larsson's novel, only in a negative sense, really, just as the case with Wentworth Miller. So, I don't know.
No, I mean, that makes sense.
But seriously, Steve Zaillian looks like he did like a lot of coke.
Well, it's Hollywood, you know?
I mean, just Google image shows a picture of him. It's
all right, everyone. That is your homework. So, yeah, I think, I don't know, plot troubles and writing troubles aside, yeah, I'd have to say this is a... I did not regret seeing this movie, and I will probably see it again, and I will probably make my friends see it, because I'm the type of sadistic bastard who likes to do that. Danny, I assume that you were also positive on this to the point where you would recommend it?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so unqualified recommendation from Danny, tempered recommendation from Nick and I. That's it. That's our review of Stoker, guys. Thanks for dropping by. Let us now go into the things that are going to be released on DVD this week, DVD and Blu-ray. A number of fantastic films and The Hobbit. We have, we have Zero Dark Thirty. We have the Blu-ray Criterion release of Badlands. We have one of the best films that I've seen so far this year, even though it came out last year, Rust and Bone, which, as you know, you will be able to win a copy of at the end of this podcast, so stick around to figure out how to do that. We also have the movie Bachelorette, which was supposed to be very good, but unfortunately I never saw. And, some other random stuff coming out. But yeah, guys, what do we think are some of the best choices for films to take home this week?
Badlands.
Yeah.
And Zero Dark Thirty as well. I'm not sure how much I'd actually rewatch that.
I don't think that I would ever watch Zero Dark Thirty again. I probably watch it about its quality, but it's just I'm done.
Yeah, it's sort of an exhausting experience, and it's, you know, Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which I've actually never seen, I have to admit, but I should see it at some point. So when it's on Blu-ray, that's as good an excuse as any. I'm curious about Rust and Bone. You know, The Hobbit.
The Hobbit was
not as bad.
Awful.
I didn't think it was as bad as some of you claimed. But by the way, should we maybe mention the Friday releases? Two big.
There's films coming out on Friday.
Two big wintry pictures.
Oh yeah, look at that. So this Friday,
God,
apparently.
That is a terrible double bill.
this is weird. Apparently, there are Friday releases. So you could get your Les Miserables on. That's pretty awesome. I will actually probably be picking that up. Also, this is 40. Right.
What? You're going to what?
I'm going to probably pick up Les Miserables. Nick, we didn't talk about Les Miserables on this podcast, did we?
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
That's a missed opportunity. Wait, you haven't even seen it?
No.
You probably wouldn't like it. You know, it depends on the human emotion.
No, I don't like bad directing.
So. Oh, snap.
I've seen like enough of it, honestly, which I know doesn't sound great, but I've seen enough of it, and I've heard enough. Where I know friend of the show Jeremy Smith has claimed very sort of resolutely that it's an objectively bad film, which what? I find pretty funny.
I don't know how that's, I guess, sure, why not? I don't know. I keep hearing people have such huge problems with it, and I'm just like, I don't see it. But, you know, I'm a Luddite, so what do I know?
I don't know what being a Luddite has to do with
it. I don't know what being a Luddite has to do with it either.
If it was,
I think, you know, I was Philistine is what I was going for.
Right. Yeah. I've made that mistake before.
Yeah. I also suck at words, apparently. Then there's This Is 40, which I did not see, but you can pick that up on unrated Blu-ray. And, yeah, I had no idea. No idea that those were coming out Friday. I don't know why they're coming out Friday, but I'm going to stick with my top choices. Badlands, fantastic debut by Terrence Malick on Blu-ray. And Rust and Bone, which has the best use of a Katy Perry song in anything ever. Look for it, guys. It's a fantastic scene. I say this with, like, absolutely no irony. It just really is.
Yeah, I didn't see This Is 40, but I felt weirdly guilty for that, because I'm a big Apatow fan. So
yeah, I'm a fan of his as well. I did read the screenplay, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's that.
I guess. I mean, it's not like Apatow is a great visual stylist. So.
No. All right. Anyway, so that's that. We can move on then into the films that will be hitting theaters on March 22nd. It's a banner week, fellas. We have Olympus Has Fallen, the action thriller directed by Antoine Fuqua, starring Gerard Butler, Aaron Eckhart, Morgan Freeman, and Angela Bassett. We also have The Croods, the newest film by DreamWorks Animation. It's about a group of prehistoric people. It looks not that fantastic. It features the voices of Nicolas Cage, Ryan Reynolds, Emma Stone, and Catherine Keener. We then also have Admission, which is the dreadful-looking comedy, question mark, with Tina Fey and Paul Rudd. We have something called The Sapphires, which I've never heard of, as well as Starbuck, which I've also not heard of, and Gimme the Loot, which I saw a trailer for in front of Stoker and actually looked pretty good. So guys, thoughts on movies coming out on March 22nd?
Stay home.
Stay home, guys.
I mean, you know, unless there's like a limited release playing near you, or you haven't seen Stoker yet, or...
Yeah.
Well, we'll be talking about Spring Breakers, right?
I believe we are. Oh, yeah. That
are we?
Why?
I'm quite looking forward to Spring Breakers.
When does Spring Breakers come out?
It's already out, but only in New York and LA, I think.
Okay, well, how the hell am I supposed to see it?
It'll expand Friday.
Oh, does it? How come that's not on my thing? Oh, because it already came out. Is that it?
Oh, yeah, right.
Anyway, yeah, Spring Breakers is out somewhere, so you should check that out, because that is what we'll be talking about.
And also, I would recommend everyone to watch the trailer for Starbuck.
Okay.
It's about, I've seen this trailer like four times because I went to the same theater like four times this past week, and they played it before every movie. And it's about a guy who, he's like this 40-something guy, and he finds out that he fathered like 500 kids through his sperm donations when he was like a young guy.
What?
And so he goes and like tries to meet every one of his 500 kids.
Holy shit.
And I highly recommend an ironic viewing of the trailer.
Oh, so you're not saying it's going to be good.
No, it looks like kind of like a crappy movie. But
okay. Well, that's fun. So yeah, ironically view the Starbuck trailer. We will get into the things that we've recently watched that we think you all should check out. And then right after that, we will tell you how you can win Rust and Bone, one of the movies that I'm most looking forward to picking up myself, but I unfortunately have to buy it because I am not qualified to win anything. Damn it. Anyway, Nick, why don't you tell us something that you saw that you think people should check out?
Okay, I will.
Yeah, good. Excellent.
One of the movies that I watched in the past week that I quite liked, which probably would have maybe been my recommendation otherwise, is something that Danny also viewed in a very strange coincidence. So I'll let him take that. In the meantime, I'll talk about Ordet from Carl Theodor Dreyer, best known perhaps as the director of The Passion of Joan of Arc. This is a movie that I have wanted to see for a little while and just never quite got around to. Mostly because it was a movie that I didn't really think to myself, oh, I should probably watch this. It's just one of those happenstances, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. And I finally, Saturday night, just, you know, I was watching something and the connection wasn't really working, so I decided to give this a shot, and I ended up watching one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Whoa.
Which, you know, obviously I don't say a lot, so take my word for it when I trust me that I mean that. Ordé is a story of multi-tiered religious belief and interaction and consequence and struggle. But to say that is to simplify it. I don't know if you can do this movie justice by just talking about it in a few simple terms, because every scene demands not just your full attention, but it demands a complex deconstruction as well, not just in the writing, but in the framing and the blocking and the editing. Everything about this movie snaps together perfectly, but it snaps together so complexly. Complexly? Is that a word? I don't know if that's a word.
With
it snaps together
I guess a word.
With complexity in a complex manner. It is complex, I should say.
Okay.
So if there are any people who are listening and if they have a Hulu Plus account, I just tell you, go see it. Even then, it's not difficult to find because it's in the Criterion Collection. The film, it's an absolute masterpiece. So that's really all I can amount to right now.
Excellent. Well, Danny, what about yourself?
Well, the film I watched that Nick also watched is called Hardcore, and it was made in 1979, and it was the second directorial film from Paul Schrader, who's kind of very well respected for writing Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. And Hardcore, for some reason, I didn't really know what to expect from it, and maybe just because it was his second film, I didn't have super high expectations. But it's actually a pretty great movie, and I think I can convince you by just sort of telling you what the plot is. George C. Scott plays a kind of pent-up Midwestern guy who's very religious. He's a single dad. He raises his daughter very religiously, and then she goes on a church retreat. She gets lost, and then he finds her in a snuff film. And so this kind of brings George C. Scott to Los Angeles through the kind of porno scene there. And basically a lot of the movie is him walking into these brothels and asking women, do you know where my daughter is? And they say, sir, it is $40 for a half hour. And he says, I'm not interested in sex. I'm interested in finding my daughter. And they say, yes, sir, that is very good. But can you pay your $40 first? And he starts to get very angry. And that's kind of the pleasure of the movie, is just watching this kind of very traditional father figure sort of become this lurid figure to find his daughter. And there are some great scenes where George C. Scott disguises himself as a filmmaker in the adult film industry. And maybe the best sequence is when he auditions actors for like a fake movie, and they're sort of like showing him their bodies, and he is very uncomfortable, but he has to hide that under a hairpiece and a mustache. And so the whole movie was just like an insane pleasure. And yeah, I kind of like want to watch it again, just talking about it.
Sounds incredible.
Yeah.
Very, very complex, again, using that word for two very different movies, balance of tone, because it is a very horrifying, scary situation, but at the same time, Schrader is able to mine basically whatever comedic circumstances could go into this, and he's able to not only mine them, but exploit them for their full effect. And it helps that, Danny sort of alludes to this, it helps that it's George C. Scott, who's this very serious, almost perpetually grumpy character, being forced into this situation. And he's wearing this ridiculous mustache and wig, which just does not look anywhere approaching realistic. And it was just such a fascinating viewing experience, because it's hugely entertaining, even though it's this horrifying story. And it made me feel bad, honestly, for not seeing more Paul Schrader films, too.
Well, you'll have your chance later this year.
Oh, with the Canyon.
All right.
Yeah.
This movie, not the Canyons, but Hardcore, is on Amazon Instant Video. One click rental.
Oh, nice.
$2.99 for a 24-hour rental. So I might have to check that out, because that sounds bananas. As for myself, the film that I saw well, it's not a film.
It's not a film?
No, it is not. It is not. This is not a film. The thing itself is not a film. I saw the BBC's modern production of Sherlock. Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah,
with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, okay.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and Martin the Hobbit Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really good.
It is. Did you watch
it a new season or?
No,
did you watch the whole thing?
Not the whole thing, no. I think over the course of the past week, I've watched three or four.
Yeah, because each season is comprised of three episodes.
Yeah, so I don't know how much continuity there is between them. I think I skipped one of them. Oops. But no, it's good. It's fun. The best part is that it's one of those detective stories that it plays fair with the audience. Like, they're not a giant reveal where it's like some character who was never introduced before. And if you're paying attention, you can kind of pick up on things with them. And the best thing is that the deductive methods of Sherlock Holmes are left intact. And even though he's kind of a jerk, he sometimes notices that he's being a jerk, and he vaguely cares a little bit. I don't know. They do a better job rounding out the character than they do in the Guy Ritchie films, which is a very low bar to set modern expectations for. But I guess that's where we're at. The acting is uniformly great, and the way that they illustrate his deductive process is pretty awesome as well. There's little subtitles and superimposed, like, words and ideas and phrases over everything. It's pretty nice. It's pretty awesome. And now I know where they got the texting from House of Cards, the texting animations.
Yep,
because
that's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's on Netflix. They've got two seasons. Is there a third season coming out?
It's going to start filming very soon.
Yeah, because they're the British, so they can take, like, 2 years between seasons and only have three episodes, and they can be an hour and a half long. Yeah, that's why I'm saying this, because, you know, it's an hour and a half. It's basically a movie. It's about as long as Stoker was. So, yeah, check it out, Sherlock. It's on a Netflix Instant, and you could do a lot worse with your time. But that is it. Before we go, before we tell you where we can be found, this is how you can win that fantastic, much-coveted Rust and Bone DVD. All you have to do is email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com and tell us what your favorite Marion Cotillard performance was. So maybe you're a fan of her in Levy and Rose. Maybe you thought that she was pretty good in Inception. Maybe you liked how she was in The Dark Knight Rises. I'm basically
Public
helping
Enemies.
You out, guys. Public Enemies, of course. I'm really giving you a lot of options here. Like, really all you have to do is, like, email us with one of those. And, you're golden. This isn't an essay contest. We're not going to pick the person that writes the best. But yeah, you send us it in, and you will be entered in to win a random drawing for the DVD of Rust and Bone. How can you lose? We ship it to you. You don't even have to pay shipping and handling. We're not like one of those crappy, like, TV offers where they still try to gouge you with that. We really just want to give you this fantastic film. If you want to know if the film is any good before you buy it, I'm sure you can find the review on thefilmstage.com. You can also find my own personal review on my personal blog, dearfilm.net, or you could probably go through all my tweets on Twitter at twitter.com/BrianJRowan and see where I talked about how awesome it was. So that's me plugging all of my stuff. Danny, why don't you tell us where you can be found?
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
Excellent. And Nick, what about yourself?
TheFilmStage.com and Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. And come back next week when we'll be discussing the new film by Harmony Korine, Spring Breakers, which stars Selena Gomez and James Franco.
They should call you Stroker.